Welcome to the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including playing the Game Boy in the backseat of your family station wagon on your summer road trip. I am Daniel Winter.
I am Mark Uessa.
Sorry if that analogy did any psychic damage there, Mark.
I have very fond memories of playing the OG, like, gray boy, as I like to call it, in the backseat of the car. Took a road trip down to California, I believe, when I was like 10 or 11. It was great.
Excellent. Yeah, I think it was my grandmother's red Volvo, specifically. My cousin had the old gray boy. I lucked into a color a few years later. But enough of that.
I have a Game Boy Color sitting over there, actually. I can pull it now.
Well, okay. Today we're going to be talking about Pacific Drive, a recent video game. But before that, we've got a couple of other things to talk about, some news and other games we've been playing. So, Mark, is anything news to you?
Not very new to me. I mean, I guess we'll cover it in the games we've been playing, but I've been playing a lot of video games, not a lot of board games or role-playing games of late.
Excellent. Well, a couple of quick bits of news I wanted to talk about. They're not super new as it is. This is our... It's been a while since we've had a regular episode, so this is old news for now, but a couple of things of interest to me, at least, is that there's been a couple of video game adaptations to the tabletop been announced. First of these is a Mass Effect board game. This is coming out from Eric Lang and Calvin Wong Se-Lun, a fan of both of them, but I'm not a huge fan of Mass Effect. I don't know if you've got any particularly strong feelings on that series.
Yeah, I played the whole trilogy all the way till the end. I was a fan of BioWare, like the KOTOR phase, obviously, right? KOTOR 1 and 2. Played both of those as well. I'm like a medium fan of Mass Effect.
Yeah, I played the first one a couple of times and really enjoyed that. I bounced off 2 twice, even though that's like, by most accounts, the best of them. I don't know. I got too caught up in the Citadel, and it's one of those RPGs where you hit the big town, too much to do. Oh well, but that's enough about the video game. The board game should be very interesting. It's going more of a story based game, and those two have been advocates for accessible games with sort of simple rule sets that anyone can get into. So that's certainly to be celebrated. So looking forward to what they do with that. One other quick announcement was they've what was it called? Don't Starve. It's also going to be a board game. So that's the survival game from Clay, and the board game version is going to be from Glass Cannon Unplugged, who I believe did Frostpunk adaptation. That's got some decent buzz. So I don't know if you've got any feelings on Don't Starve.
I'm a big fan of Don't Starve. I think Clay is great in general. Like,
and local studio.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a huge fan of their, what is it, Oxygen Not Included?
Yeah,
so probably my number one game of theirs. But Don't Starve itself is great, and Don't Starve Together is a lot of fun as well. My kid doesn't love it because they find it a bit too creepy artwork. But I think
very
that's intentional,
gothic sort of
right?
tone, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very kind of Tim Burton. The crafting is great and the survival is cool. Yeah, it was one of my early survival crafting games for sure.
I mean, I've struggled with the video game. It's very punishing. It's like a run based thing where if you die, you just lose everything, start all over again. And those runs can be hours. So it's quite punishing. I do love the vibes and the art style though. So I'm quite curious to see how the board game will capture that with maybe a different pacing that isn't quite so punishing, and it's obviously I assume the runs will be quite shorter for a board game. So yeah, I'm looking forward to them playing with that world.
Very cool.
And I've mentioned before I'd like to try and take a closer look at Don't Starve Together sometime, maybe for a future pod.
Anytime, I'll play that. Yeah, whenever you say.
Excellent. Let's keep an eye on that. So
nice.
From the future to the present, what have you been playing lately?
Yeah, well, you mentioned roguelikes, so why don't I talk about a roguelite that I've been playing? It's called Balatro Mania, yes. Has hit this home, and this is a title that I've been actually actively trying to avoid,
yep.
Because I knew exactly what buttons it would be pressing, I knew exactly what sort of like endorphins it would be injecting into me. So I was like, I'll get to it when I get to it. But I love it to bits. I'm discovering the subtleties of the design, the types of cards. I thought were an interesting, turned out to be some of the more interesting options available. The way that the different booster packs work, I assume they worked a certain way. When I, you know, actually tried them hands on, they worked in a different way than I thought. So yeah, there's layers to this onion, and I'm still unraveling them. So I would like to talk about it more in depth in the future.
So for those unfamiliar, those few people who haven't been infected with the Bellatro bug, so this is a poker like. Well, you're playing with poker hands, right?
That's
you,
right.
You have a hand of cards, like 10 cards, say, and then you're playing cards as poker hands to earn points.
Yes, it's a larger hand than a typical game of poker, and you're right, it's not actual poker because you're not playing against AI or human opponents. You're just trying to make the best hands you can make. So basically, it's really easy early on to make those numbers with just the straight value of the cards. But to get those high numbers, you need to basically inject juice into your engine. And that can either come through Joker cards, of which you can have 5 at a time. And those sort of act like the artifacts in Slay the Spire. So they're persistent.
Mm.
They stay with you throughout your entire run. Or you can sort of call cards, or you can enhance cards. So, for instance, you could upgrade the card values permanently. So, so if you're going to go for a two-pair strategy, you can make two-pair that particular hand more valuable in its combinations persistently over the course of the entire run. So it's quite addictive. It's kind of cerebral, but it's also like sending you those endorphins, just like a game of you know, Vampire Survivors or
yeah, that was definitely a Monster comparison Train. Point in terms of like Vampire Survivor came to mind specifically in how it's triggering those sort of gambling buttons.
Yeah, it's those like endorphins. You're playing video poker too. Like the UI is very lo-fi. It's got this kind of like 8-bit, 8.5-bit kind of look to it. And it's cute. It's addictive. It's it kind of takes over your mind. And I'm just trying to fight my mind virus, right?
I do think it's quite clever in using the language of poker as like as an accessibility point. Like you don't have to learn some antiquated like Slay the Spire, like all the swords and the shields and all this new system. Like you just, if you know poker, you've got a point of reference for getting into this, which makes it a pretty accessible version. I think I played this during the demo in the Steam Next Fest. I don't remember if I talked about that. And I found it a really fascinating like experiment in game design. I am kind of glad I'm inoculated to the appeal of this. I don't see the appeal. I'm just chasing numbers. Make number go up. It's a really cool concept, but I feel kind of very arbitrary just trying to get chasing this high score. That's not what sort of motivates me as a gamer. It's a little too, maybe a little bit of theme just would help here.
I mean, like it's a fun pastime, right? It's not supposed to be a be all and end all game that slays all other games. It's just one of many other games you can play to pass your time.
If it was on mobile, I'd probably poke at it some more, just as a like on the bus. Not something I want to be sitting at my computer and playing 3 hours of though.
Yeah, well, I don't play this game like with my head facing it, right? This is just like something I scan over. It's like a machine that I fiddle with, or like a cactus that I water over into the corner. So for that, it's working really well.
Excellent. Well, in the video game space, I have been playing quite a few things lately, picking at a few various games, but I'm still picking at, like a month later, I'm still playing through Yakuza Like a Dragon. That's something I just keep coming back to. And I'm past the point of like, I'm in deep now. I'm hooked, put it that way. I'm about chapter 6 or so, I think it is. And the thing I really am appreciating in this compared to Yakuza 0, which I bounced off of, is how it eases you into the systems. I remember Yakuza 0 literally opens with like a karaoke game, and it's throwing your mini games and checklists and sub stories at you very quickly from the get go. This eases you into the story and makes you invested in the characters first, and then starts sprinkling in those other sub stories and mini games. And the mini games are like pretty fleshed out here. There's a whole Mario Kart like analog in here, Dragon Kart, I think it's called. There's the collecting cans, which is like a little Pac-Man mini game. It's quite fun. And the story, like you said, it gives you time to get hooked on the story before you get overwhelmed with everything else. And that's really the strong point here. Like, the characters are all very strong. And the thing that really gets me is how this game how it balances the different tones. It's incredibly wacky. It's this wild world where everyone, like, everything is solved via fist fights. And yet, it'll go from that to, like, these very heartfelt conversations. And, like, it's pretty... I was a little worried, especially in some of the ways it treats things like homelessness. It can play a little loose with that sometimes, but ultimately comes down on really respecting. Like, it has a lot of respect for those on the sort of underside of society. Like, both homeless people, sex workers, it's quite respectful too. It's not punching down, largely. And I think it does a pretty good job of balancing those themes and the charm of the characters.
Right, yeah. In that way, this game carries on the hallmark qualities of the other Yakuza games entries. I think you probably gave yourself a raw deal by starting with Yakuza 0, because it's literally not the first Yakuza game.
Yes, yeah.
It is like the third or fourth Yakuza game that came out. So it's probably expecting you to be familiar with the sorts of things. So, right. So this game, this particular game, Like a Dragon, is sort of like a reboot, right?
Mm.
So it doesn't really expect you to know much. There is some nods to the past history there, but mostly in the way that, it's a story about characters. And the fist fighting is like besides the point. And, you know, part of you just talking right now made me think, like, are they fist fighting at all? Because
or is it all in his head, right?
Yeah, because the main character, Ichiban, like, he fantasizes, right? Like, it's right there in the narrative that he's fantasizing that he's playing a video game RPG.
Specifically, so, Dragon Quest, like, quite explicitly. Yeah.
Are you really engaging in fist fights at all? Like, maybe he's just hallucinating this whole time.
Yeah.
In his mind. But I played a chapter and got into a meaty narrative section just recently. I think I'm on chapter 12 now. And, you know, I'm enjoying it, every step of the way. But that's a game I can, like, step away from and come back to.
Yeah.
And I don't feel too lost, because it's mostly you're just kind of wandering anyway. And eventually you can
walk
find
to the next story
back.
Checkpoint and watch the cutscene for half an hour, right?
Yeah. Yeah, a good one. All right, I'll mention a couple others I've been playing. Diablo 4, another big time waster, has hit.
It's back on
Xbox.
Game Pass.
It's finally on Game Pass because of the merger, of course, the acquisition. So everyone expected this to come. I knew it would come, so that's why I didn't buy Diablo 4 on retail. And as expected, it's like slick. It plays really smoothly. I appreciate a lot of the quality of life improvements. I play this, and I say this as level 24 or 25 already after just like a week or something. It's kind of boring. It's kind of lacking charm, a coherent narrative. It's really not saying anything new. It just plays like a really polished title, but it's got no heart.
I felt kind of similar
yet.
But I can't really put my finger on how it's different from Diablo 2. Is it just that I'm not 14 anymore? Is that what's changed? Am I the problem? Am I out of touch?
Yeah, I never got too deep into the Diablo. But this just seems kind of like even less charming than those other entries, which weren't that exciting.
Yeah, I mean, they are, it's still fun in a very Pavlovian sense of click on things, watch them explode. You're getting a lot of immediate feedback and some firing off cool abilities and things. I think it's just the loot doesn't really hold the appeal for me anymore. But partly just it's so much, like, chaff to filter through. You're just constantly overloaded with just random junk, and finding the good stuff is few and far between. But it's just really hard to care about any, like, what do I want to find here? What like I don't have a particular goal. I don't have a particular like legendary item that I'm trying to find. It's just look for something with slightly better numbers than what I've already got. I am curious to go back. I remember I played this on PC, beat the main story, and I remember thinking it felt like it was designed for console, which I know was the case with Diablo 3 at least. So I'm curious to try it on console just to see how it feels there.
I'm playing a necromancer. I literally siphon life out and buff myself and heal myself. And I'm just like mowing things down. And I have like 8 skeletons following me, like hacking and slashing at whatever. And I'm just like button mashing. And, you know, maybe turning the stick to point my my attack around. And I'm just not feeling anything.
Like that core loop is pretty like...
There's no challenge.
Yeah.
There's no differentiation. Like, I don't even remember what the buttons do because I'm just mashing them.
You just like, go into a fugue state of clicking things, right? Without really being engaged.
Yeah, like the activity is not that exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I love Diablo 2 back in the day, but maybe the world doesn't need Diablo anymore.
Or, you know, like maybe I'm missing the point. Like, thankfully, it is a game that I can kind of like pop in for like 10, 20 minutes at a time. Yep. It's a very smooth transition. Like, there's nothing technically wrong with the game. It's like so smooth. It runs like a dream. It looks great. I like the kind of closer camera angles. The art, you know, for how drab it is, looks good. So, like, no complaints there. They did good work. It's just not exciting me. I'm going to mention another a game that I actually started and finished very quickly. It's a Game Pass game. It's called Return to Grace. I think you played a little bit of this game.
Yeah,
right?
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. This is like a 3-4 hour game. I finished it in 2 sittings. And it's kind of like a walking simulator. It's futuristic, but kind of in this like sort of 1950s 70s, like retro future.
Like, retro sci-fi, yeah.
Retro sci-fi sort of thing. And it's got like a very kind of far-reaching like kind of scope of the story. Like you kind of get to like reset the galaxy for like millions of people at the end of the story, which was kind of cool. It leaves you with this sort of like question mark, like is this right? Should I be doing
this? You do get choices, right? Like I at the point I played up to, it was very linear, no real divergence, but I did hear that you do get some choices later on.
Yeah, you do get some choices, but they're quite binary, so it's probably like I experienced maybe like 3 or 4 branches, but they were not really significant. It was like take path A or take path B, and you still wind up at junction C eventually. But there was still some cool choices, like it allows you to fail, and it makes that failure part of the
That's
progress.
Cool. Yeah,
and that was built in. It's just like
failing forward.
You have to make that choice. And it, unlike Diablo 4, it is actually chock full of personality. I really appreciated the different sort of like AI companions. Basically, there's very few characters in this game, living characters. There's pretty much like there's no other living characters that you encounter in this game. There's just voices in your head.
Playing with like archetypes, sort of like inside out, like certain personalities as an AI concept. Right.
Yeah, like the story lays itself out well within the framework of like good science fiction, like actual traditional, like kind of like Isaac Asimov era, Ray Bradbury. That's why I mentioned the 50s, because it's like really old school.
Sure, it's very speculative science fiction.
Science fiction, yeah. Like nothing like the sort of done to death Star Wars, you know, sequel, side story missions, this and that. It just seems like a nice, clean science fiction story, like an episode
in
of,
and out.
I don't know, like
Twilight Zone or
Outer Limits or something. And it was done, and it was sweet, and I enjoyed it. Not hard. So if you just want to experience kind of an interesting sci-fi story, go check it out.
And also Game Pass. Well, let's just bounce quickly into the tabletop sphere for a little while. I've actually played quite a few things this last month. A couple of heavier Euro games like Kutnohora and Voidfall. I will probably save those for next episode, because I actually want to talk about a couple of lighter games at Terminal City that we discussed last episode. I mentioned some of the sort of demos and prototypes I tried, but in between all that, I did manage to play a few other just lighter games that I wouldn't normally get to. So first of those is The King Is Dead. So I think we played this together at one point.
Yeah.
So this is from Osprey Games and designed by Pierre Sylvester. So what this is a super elegant little area control game. It's eight regions, a map of the UK, eight regions, and you've got eight turns. With the forces of Scotland, Wales, and Britain sort of fighting over these locations. You're not playing as these forces, though. You're sort of just jostling for their influence. They are sort of neutral parties, and you're sort of kind of betting on which one of these you want to win, almost like playing the stock market. So generally, you've got eight actions. Each one of these you place will move some cubes around the board to represent their influence. But it always results in you pulling a unit off of the board. Sorry, pulling one of these cubes off the board, which both changes what influence they have on the board, but also increases your influence with that faction. So if at the end of the game, the Welsh control the most zones, the player with the most Welsh cubes in front of them wins the game. So that's a really fascinating concept. Like you can play it within half an hour. This is really quintessential sort of knife fight in a phone booth game. I'm terrible at it. I can't wrap my head around the strategy necessarily, but it's so immediate. Just you play a card, pull a cube. I'm really enjoying that central puzzle of it. Even if I can't quite wrap my head around it, it's just a really elegant, streamlined little game.
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. Maybe part of that was because I won the game.
That helps.
I beat you and who was it, Joe, we were playing with, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're right. It's very tight. It's very intimate. I think this is not a very intimidating game, although I guess it's a easy to learn, maybe difficult to master game would be a good probably place to put it. Like it's lighter than Small World. Like pretty much
it is a beige map of Europe for what it's worth, but the rules are very accessible.
But it's quite intriguing. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It's just really, really tight. I liked it,
and I've played it like half a dozen times over this last month, but it scales really well at both 2, 3, and 4 players. At 4 you actually have to play teams.
Okay.
And alternating teams, and the really interesting thing about that is you don't pool your influence with the factions. It's like either whichever player has the most influence in a faction, that team wins. Okay. Shall we leave it there?
Yeah. Let's take a drive, shall we?
Excellent. Let's put it in park to get take a break, and we'll be back shortly.
All right, so we are back on the road now from our roadside stop, driving down the I-5, turning off into the Olympic Peninsula. For a nice little jaunt in our station wagon. We are, of course, talking about Pacific Drive, which is a game from developer Ironwood Studios, published by Kepler Interactive, and this game came out just this year, right? 2024?
Yes, yep, correct.
Right. So tell us, Daniel, what type of game is this?
So that's the thing. I remember looking at this a while back and thinking it was a very linear sort of walking simulator, similar to what you mentioned, more in the line of say, Firewatch is what I was expecting, with a car. What I got is something very different. This is an immersive sim roguelite. So how do we begin? Set in an exclusion zone, one of my favorite tropes. You got an exclusion zone here. You're trapped within here with all kinds of anomalies, and just you in a station wagon, and some weirdos on the radio. Going on runs to collect resources to upgrade your car. So very much a survival type game, similar to how we were talking about Don't Starve earlier, in that you're collecting resources to both increase your car, increase your base, increase your survivability. There is a story threading through these, but largely in between, you're going on runs to just to collect resources.
Yeah, you are playing in the first person. Mm. You never see yourself. Basically, there's a garage that you're upgrading in addition to the car, and I think the garage has a mirror, but you never see yourself. You never see your hands. So you're basically just this first person manipulating things, mostly tools or automotive parts. And so your station wagon is omnipresent, and I don't even know if it has a name. You don't have a name. You're called the driver. There are these disembodied head characters, but you're always in the first person, whether you're driving or you're walking. So you can get in and out of the car. And that first of all, is quite cool. Because not every game makes you do that.
It's like a moving base, basically.
Yeah. Right, it's kind of like a shield that you take with you, and it was also sort of like your pack mule. So it is like a character, it's a companion. You can load things up, you can maintain it and take care of it, and that's sort of like this relationship that you form with
it. It's a very symbiotic relationship. There was a note from the lead designer. Let me find that. Where was this? From Seth Rosen. Said, the car's health is generally a better indicator of how a run is going to go than your own.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. At times, like, your health doesn't matter at all. A lot of runs, your health is irrelevant. It hardly budges. But
you can just throw in a health pack, chug a food ration pack, and you're fine, right? The car requires a lot more TLC.
Right. So there would be like some situations where you'd be driving, and then there'd be like an electrical field or something like that. And of course, that would affect both you and the car. And then other times there might be a radiation field, and that would affect both you and the car. But as part of the upgrades that you can unlock and build, you can unlock like radiation shielding. Or electrical shielding, or you can
off-road tires.
off-road tires, you can create a kind of like a lightning rod to collect electricity, which protects you from electricity, but it also fuels your car battery. Ooh, which is sort of like a resource that you need to upgrade as well. So there's lots of cool kind of interactions between you, the vehicle. So you and the vehicle are kind of this joint thing.
Yeah, there's a big metal layer of upgrades there that I was really surprised how many. Like, I saw this huge web of here's all the upgrades you can get, like a couple dozen upgrades, and I realized that's just one tab. There's like a dozen tabs that all have their own web of upgrades.
Yeah, upgrading upgrading in this game is pretty central to your survivability. I was running into like a brick wall, just failing and failing and failing my runs until I realized that I had to invest more in that, and when that was one of the early lessons I learned. So cycling back to the basics, this game is very much about car maintenance. So car maintenance, like, it's kind of a car maintenance simulator, really.
Yeah.
A large chunks, basically in between all of your runs, you're returning to this omnipresent kind of garage, which you it starts very modest at first, but you unlock new kind of workstations and tools and upgrades at that place. It's where you can heal yourself. It's where you can charge your car battery, fill up, top up with gas, and then basically create the new parts to repair your car. So car maintenance simulation is a big part of it. And there's also this underlying kind of horror/creepy element to it. Although I wouldn't say that it's really central.
It's a very unnerving game. It's there's so many sound effects, rustling leaves and the undergrowth, that I don't know if anything's actually there, but was certainly it sets the tone without it being a direct sort of monster's going to jump out and eat you. It's not let's talk a little bit about the zone, just to set the scene. This is an exclusion zone. As I mentioned, one of my favorite sort of tropes. I don't know if you're familiar with like Roadside Picnic or Stalker. Annihilation probably is the recent film. It's a similar, playing in a similar space. One of my favorite films from recently. But basically these exclusion zones where something has gone wrong, whether it's aliens or science, some esoteric, unknowable force is within this zone making things go bad. So it's a sort of alternate history sometime in the 50s, I think. There's been a bunch of experiments in the Olympic Peninsula that's gone wrong, question mark. And now this is set in the 70s, I think. Or do I have it mixed up?
Perhaps. It was kind of hard to determine like when this game took place at all. Like,
it's sort of locked in time, right? Everything in the zone.
Yeah, there was a sort of timelessness about it. But I sort of like pictured it was around the 70s, 80s. I got a very kind of like, I don't know, like what was it? Close Encounters of the Third Kind or X-Files, even the sort of like generic kind of creepy science gone wrong quality.
Yeah, so it's more science, sort of almost Tesla punk kind of electricity and flashing lights. It's not really creepy horror stuff. It's a lot of weird lights and particle effects are going on in the zone. So we hinted earlier, you've actually been on location in the Olympic Peninsula.
Yeah, that's right. I took a road trip with my family just before TCTC. Was it before TCTC?
I think it was after.
It was a month ago. And I visited the Olympic Peninsula. Like I knew there were parts of Washington State that I hadn't visited other than like the main cities. And it's just sort of like it's literally off the beaten path, right? Like most people just go up and down the I-5, and I was just thinking, oh, this could be a affordable family getaway. And we sort of went mostly to the coast. We wanted to see some of the beaches. There's some interesting terrain out there, some visual features. There's this amazing thing called the Tree of Life, just this like tree that's like trying to hang alive between this like crevasse that's being eroded away, and all the roots are exposed, but somehow the tree's still going and it's still alive. And so the ocean is very majestic when you're there, and there's these sort of like small meandering rivers, these beautiful lakes, but most prominent are this very imposing forest, obviously. Trees, like we're in quote-unquote the Pacific Northwest. We're in the temperate rainforest of British Columbia up here. It's not so different than what's there in Washington State. But when you're in that park area, you feel quite removed. It feels far away, even though you're literally not that far from Seattle or Olympia. You're only about an hour's drive away. But you feel like it's kind of otherworldly, you know, like you feel like you're in the forest. And I would say we had amazing weather, by the way. It was like so beautiful and sunny. It was like uncharacteristically sunny for mid-March or so.
But no endless fog.
No, there was not much fog at all, to be honest. There was a little bit of drizzling rain, but like it was nothing like the sort of doom and gloom of weather, of kind of just endless dreary weather that this game pushed. This game is different from reality in the sense that there's not a lot of off-roading you're going to be doing in the Olympic National Park, right? Like there's no spaces between the trees. You're not going to be driving like just clever path to outrun the whatever the storm that's going to
trees
take
run
you
this
out.
Town.
Yeah, literally. Like if you run into the trees, you're going to hit a tree. So good luck. that's just their literal fiction. It's very different from the sheer creepiness of the game.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about what sort of things you're going to run into. What are some of these anomalies in Pacific Drive?
Right. So you are going to... It's a little repetitive. Like a lot of these things... Like I wasn't able to determine whether all of the regions that you visit are procedurally generated every time.
Yeah, I was a little unsure about that. So you basically you go into a map. Like, even if you might want to go to somewhere across the zone, but you have to go through several smaller maps to get there. And each map, I believe, is somewhat procedurally generated. They quoted Spelunky as an inspiration in that case. So sort of working with tiles and but sort of randomized each map.
Right. Yeah, I think it is procedurally generated, then it must. But the each of the regions, sort of like, imagine like the nodes within a Slay the Spire run, right? Mm. So there's these like branching biomes, paths.
Right?
Yeah, and they'll literally tell you in the map, it'll tell you, this place is likely to have these conditions, these hazards, these are all green, this is all good, this is watch out for this is yellow, this is red, sort of thing. It'll give you sort of a breakdown of what you can expect. And basically, the anomalies you'll encounter are spinning saw blades, driving across the ground, connected to nothing. These little things called, what are they called? Bunnies? They're little, like, bouncing...
Yeah, bouncing bunnies. Yeah,
bouncing bunnies.
Attach themselves to your car and sort of zap its electricity.
Right, so they're sort of like, just like homunculi of metallic parts that have electricity running through them. And they sort of attach to your car like chestnuts with burrs or something like that in a pair of pants. Like, they just stick on and you have to grab them, and you can do one of two things with them. The thing I most often do will just like hold my feet back and then boot them.
Did you ever do that? They have a kick button in this game.
Yeah, there is a kick button. So you can basically hold one of these things and just reel your leg back and punt it far off into the distance. The other thing you do is just drop it on the ground, and you can pull out your scrapper, which is like this kind of like cutting tool, and you can break it down for parts.
You can break down a lot of things. Like you can break down like other wrecked cars along the way to get resources, and that's pretty versatile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The hazards were like stationary too. Like there's these like electrical towers that sort of like zap anything that come by.
Or just a circle of lights. Like I think it's called like lefty righty or something. And if you drive through this circle of lights, it'll like reverse the order that you can go in or something. Most of them are pretty localized. Like you'll see this circle of flashing lights, drive around it and keep on going.
Right.
There's the tourists. That's probably the creepiest one. Is it the Weeping Angels in Doctor Who? They're basically test dummies, these statues posed in all kinds of pained-looking poses. Yeah. And you can drive past them, and they won't do anything. They won't harm you. They do sometimes move, though.
Oh, they certainly move. Yeah,
there's some jump scares to be had, shall we say.
Yeah, for sure. Like, basically, you're doing your business. There's some, what are they called, tourists? Tourists hanging around like a gas station. Like you might run into a filling station. You'd be like, oh great, I can fill up my gas tank, which is one of the things you have to do in this game to survive. And then you're going to collect some junk out of the dumpster, whatever, collect some parts from inside the shop, and you turn around and then there's a tourist right behind you.
Yeah.
But it doesn't,
they don't actually hurt you though. No. Yeah. If you bring them with your car, they explode. But if you don't hurt them, they won't hurt you. And that's, I think, one of the key things about this game. The zone isn't hostile explicitly. It's not out to get you. It's sort of this cosmic danger that you just have to try and avoid and like recalculate what your priorities are and just stay away from the dangers of this. It's not out to hurt you. It's very indifferent to you.
For the most part, you're right. It's basically just... It's every region is an environmental hazard or a combination of like 8 or 12 environmental hazards. There's very few things that will chase after you, but there is one significant one, which you do experience early on. Right. So there's these kind of glowing. Imagine if you could picture the magnetic arm of one of those tools that you see at
like a wrecking yard?
A wrecking yard.
Yeah.
A car yard or something like that. So it's like a UFO with one of those magnetic arms, and it lowers the magnetic arm and snatches you if you get caught within its visual range. And if you happen to be driving, you can, of course, hit the gas and try and escape from it.
Outright.
But if you're not successful, it will actually slingshot you Like, it will whip you around.
It'll drag you straight into a tourist and explode.
Right. Or straight into a cliff face. Or straight into a tree. Or straight forward in the direction you were planning to go anyway.
You can utilize it sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite chaotic.
I don't know exactly what they're trying to achieve, to be honest. Again, it's a little esoteric in what the actual danger is there. I eventually figured out you can get around those by just throwing on your parking brake. Huh. And sort of, they can't really move you very far with that. You learn ways to get around all of these hazards one way or another.
Right. So mostly environmental hazards. Very few things are chasing you. Once in a while, often early on, I would feel really creeped out looking entering into buildings. Mm. So there's these kind of like cabins. There are these like kind of ironically even creepier like laboratory facilities.
Yeah.
They're kind of like trailers, but they're obviously mobile research stations. And then there's more elaborate buildings later on, like some of these towers or something like that. But for the most part, you're encountering these carbon copies of each other, these cabins or these trailers. And when I entered them, I was like, oh, this is creepy. This is really creepy. And I realized after the 10th time, it's like, nothing's ever going to get me in there.
You learn how the anomalies are predictable. You learn to understand them. And that's part of the game, is that learning experience of coming to recognize what the threat is. And largely this game ends up being about threat analysis. You pull up outside a research station and you have to analyze, well, what danger is around me? Can I afford to leave the parking brake on? Is there a tourist around that's going to creep up on me? How much time do I have? Is there radiation in the area? And it's just a sort of triage of threats, but to know how much time you have and how careful you need to be.
Right. And yeah, there's the sort of trade-offs, right? Because in a run that might have multiple legs, say you wanted to go this distance, there might be like three regions you'd have to hit. So like a three-legged route or something like that. And each of them, one of them might be very, very placid and safe. Maybe it's even daytime. Strangely enough, some of the levels are actually during the day where there's, you know, sunlight, you can see things, it's peaceful, you could raid some of these houses for supplies, you can bust down some of the cars along the side of the road for some supplies there, you can fill up your gas tank, you can really take a leisurely time of it all. And then other regions will be like quite hostile to you. I don't know exactly what triggered it, but maybe it's just merely time. But if you dally in some of the levels, I felt like it would literally like sick this storm upon you.
Oh, yeah, that will always happen unless there's a perpetual stability effect in a place.
Yeah.
After, say, 5-10 minutes, the storm will start moving in to basically force you to move on.
Yeah, it's basically like a Fortnite storm. Like,
or the ghost in Spelunky.
Yeah, it forcing you into like a corner, forcing you to a portion of the map. And if you, basically you sort of like unlock these legs as you go, you have to like visit a region and then you have to warp out.
Yeah, that was really unexplained. I did like, that was very confusing. I will say, yeah. I didn't explain that mechanic at all very well.
Yeah. Basically you're kind of having to explore as you go, but unless you get back home safely, it doesn't consider you to have actually explored that region. So there is this thing called, I don't know what they are called. What are they called? Unstable energy? Orbs?
Yeah, it's like stability nodes or something.
Yeah. They're these basically orange nodes that you see highlighted on the map. So quite early, there's like a tutorial mission where it's like, get one of these, plug it into the passenger side of your car, and it's sort of like warp fuel or something like that.
At that point of the game, so much is happening, it's really hard to take in what it all means, right? Especially early in the game, you're taking in so many systems and information. Like, you just follow the instructions. I don't know what it means. I don't know what to do going forward. It's a lot. But yeah, you grab the orb, and that lets you open a portal that you can then drive into to teleport you back.
Right.
And that will sort of save. Now that location is saved as a sort of permanent sort of gateway to go on to other locations.
Yeah, so there's this sort of like laptop computer that's sitting to the side of your workstation, of your dashboard. It's kind of like a really janky looking Tesla display or something like that. And basically you swing it around and you see a little overview map of the region that you're in. And if you find these warp out points, and you have to kind of like enable it, and then it like tunes it, and then sometimes there might be multiple warp out points, and basically you just choose one, the one you think you can get to quickly, and basically you just have to gun it.
And then the storm then arrives, like comes in, to sort
it
of
triggers the storm
out. Yeah,
and then like the storm will kind of zoom in upon that warp out point. And this is actually a cool part of the key art that you see on the art for this game, is you see this kind of like ominous pillar of light. Right. This is this yellowish pillar of light, and it's vertical, it's visible everywhere. Mm. And basically you just have to gun it for there. And quite often with weather conditions being bad or your headlights are being out, like you actually can't see a damn thing except for that pillar of light.
Oh, your battery ran out, you've got no headlights.
Right. And yeah, with this storm chasing you, that really feels exciting.
Yeah.
To chase that warp out point.
I really like that switch in tone. You go from like very slowly, methodically exploring the zone and picking through bits of scrap and being very slow and meticulous, to then suddenly it's on, your hands are gripping the steering wheel, you have this sort of grim determination as you gun it straight for the light. It feels almost like a heist, sort of you're going through this prep right. level, making sure you've got there's a portal that you can get to with enough time, and executing that and rushing.
Yeah, it's either a heist or it's almost kind of like a deep sea dive. You know, it's like you're going down into a thing and then you have to gun it to make it out.
Yeah.
Right? It's like you're building in preparation, but unless you actively extract yourself, you can't bring all the good stuff back.
Yeah.
If you fail a run, it'll warp you back home, no problem, but your car is going to be beat up to heck.
And you get none of the resources you collected.
you get none of the goodies.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the cycle I entered in to probably like the fifth mission or something like that.
Mm.
I just kept hitting that wall. Like I said, I just needed to focus more on the nearby regions, come home more safely with more supplies, unlock more upgrades, of which there were some cool ones, which I'll mention a little bit. But once I got the better car parts, at least get steel for all of your car components. And then eventually you'll get insulated parts, you'll get off-road tires, and then you start to feel like, oh, I actually will bring the health meter of your car to like at least 50%. Whereas I feel like you start off at closer to like 25% of the total potential capacity of health.
Yeah, there is a really good, great sense of progression, not just in like sheer numbers of, oh, my armor is better now, my wheels are better now, but it's unlocking new options. Like there's a little dashboard where you can unlock completely different abilities, like putting floodlights on the side of your car or a giant spring to sort of bounce you out of danger, and you can customize new options there. Really overwhelmed with the number of upgrades. It is very overwhelming at first, but it does also a lot of customization in what you want to focus on. Do you just want to get better tires so you don't have to upgrade your tires as often? Do you want to focus on the getting good headlights is a good one. Do you want to get better, like a better scrapping gear to be able to harvest things out in the wasteland, in the zone? There's quite a lot of different paths you can take to how you're going to upgrade your sort of workshop.
Yeah, I actually liked a lot of the upgrades that affected the workshop itself.
Mm.
So a couple of key ones that I recommend getting are, there's one fairly early on, which is kind of like a scrapping station. Early on, like you have to build this handheld tool called a scrapper, and you have to hold down the button and you have to manually like aim down at every piece of a part of the beat up car in your yard, or like a door or a panel, side panel, that's like at 10% health or something like that. And it's like, I can't collect enough chemicals to make repair putty for this. So I'm just going to scrap it for parts. And it's a really weird concept, because if I found a car with a door in the wild and it's at 100% health, why would I break it down to nothing into its constituent parts and fabricate a brand new door? Why don't I just take the door off? Like, I have a ratchet. Like, why can't I just do that?
Yeah, I just got the item that lets you do that. I can't put it, what it's called, the destabilizer or something.
It's like an explosive or something?
Yeah,
The Liberator.
Liberator, that's it.
Liberator. It's kind of convoluted. Like, these aren't one-to-one equivalents of real world tools.
No, it's all very weird steampunky technology.
Right. So there's this automated station where you could just plop a piece in and it will automatically bust it down for its constituent parts. So, like, it just saves you, like, 5 seconds here or four seconds there. But if you do it multiple times, like, it's just such a lifesaver.
Yeah, so often you'll get to the point where something starts to feel tedious, and then you realize, right, oh, there's actually an upgrade that will let me fast-track this.
Yeah, and those are much needed, because this game can feel quite tedious and quite repetitive, and the car repair of it component is interesting at first, and then it becomes quite laborious.
I can see it getting repetitive. I actually came to really like it as this sort of weird ritual. You come back from this run, it's been this really high stress sort of gunning it for the portal, and then you're back in your garage, everything's safe, nothing can get you in there, you can close the door of your garage now, and so just meticulously going through the ritual of repairing all my panels and replacing the tires, I found that to be very sort of calming, the zen of car maintenance.
Yeah, there is some sort of you're right, it's the right word is ritual, right? There is something like kind of like calming about going through those steps, but if it's all that effort is to bring me back to where I was before,
yeah,
then I don't feel good about that. If it's to build me up to a level above it where I'm even 10% tougher,
yeah,
that feels good.
But I remember having a particularly bad run where my car, like, I think an abductor had driven me into a tourist. Everything blew up. No doors left on my car. And so now all the upgraded equipment I had was gone. I had to completely rebuild the whole car from scratch. And that was tedious. This game can be punishing. When you're coasting along that sort of progression path, it can be very satisfying. But when you fall off the path down a cliff face, it can feel very punishing. And there are a lot of options to customize that, both through the upgrades that you choose, but also in the sort of accessibility options. You can turn off some of those more punishing elements.
Yeah, maybe the upgrades will come later. And I didn't finish this game. I only really reached barely into the mid section.
The mid zone, the poison swamp.
Yeah, which opened up some newer, more interesting terrain because I was starting to get
stranger anomalies that start to get a little weirder.
Yeah, I was starting to get a little bit bored with the outer zone, so it is nice to see.
It gets very predictable and safe in a sense, right?
Right. So I don't know. I guess maybe like the more immersive sim games that I enjoy playing, the sort of first person survival crafting games that I enjoy playing, will kind of eventually they'll automate away a lot of the tedium that the early game represents. So, you know, a game like Satisfactory, which, you know, I adore, a lot of stuff you have to do manually, like you have to tink, tink, tink with a little hammer early on to bust down every little brick. Then eventually you get machines to do it. Then you get more powerful machines to do it. Then you get a whole, like, automated operation that will just spit out a certain thing.
But you have to experience the tedium of it to then know what that automation, how much better that automation feels, right?
Right. And that's what makes you feel powerful, right?
Yes.
That's the curve. That makes you feel also liberated because you can focus your attention on other more exciting, grander things. In this, you don't ever really get fully liberated from that TDM. You just get better, tougher parts that you have to manually craft. And maybe I haven't seen all of the upgrades, so maybe there are some cool.
So this game has a lot more to offer once you hit the mid zone, it unlocks a whole extra tier of upgrades, basically.
Yeah. That said, this game has a lot going for it. It's a very intriguing game, and I like it because it tries things. Like, I haven't seen this combination of sort of levers and pulleys in maybe ever. It combines a lot of things. And this world is interesting. That said, I have some complaints to make. Mm-hmm. The disembodied characters, like, first of all, there's Ophelia, who's sort of like this, a kind of matronly character.
Disgruntled old scientist. Yeah.
Yeah. Oppie, sometimes she's called. She's sort of like, is like the, your close companion early on, close in your ear anyway. And then there's these two other guys whose names I don't even remember.
They're Francis kind of like, and...
Oh, Eugene, I can't remember his name. I don't know.
I can't help but think of them as Billy West and Andrew Dice Clay. I don't know their voices. Very, sure. Very, very strong voice performances there, shall we say.
Yeah, but like they just seem to be bickering, and then those two are bickering with Oppie, and they're sort of bickering with each other. It's like, you screwed us over in the past. There's a lot of history
here that you don't have an insight into.
Yeah, so they're sort of alluding to things. And they're talking kind of at about me, but not really like conferring with me. I don't have any input to give into their story. And
yeah, it's very passively receiving the story, right?
And the story is kind of hazy to begin with. So like, I just don't really fit. I don't know where I fit into that relationship. I don't really know where I fit into the story. I don't know who I am because I'm nothing.
You're very much a blank slate. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm disembodied hands. And my job is to take care of this car, which is silent, not living, and it has 1,000 times more personality than I do.
Well, it's right? Quirks. We need to talk about quirks.
Yeah, quirks are interesting. Did you figure out some quirks?
Yeah, well, I mean, so quirks are that your cars can develop little ticks. Like the first one I found was I turned on the windshield wiper and my fuel gauge started moving back and forth in line with the windshield wipers. And some of this fun, like that, fairly unintrusive. The other one I found that was a little more annoying was, whenever I turned, my headlights would dim. And that can get dangerous real fast. To get rid of these, you can go to this like sort of old, very old school computer terminal that you can basically plug in like an XY statements. Like if car is turning, then headlights dim. And if you can solve that solution, it'll basically let you solve the puzzle. But some of them aren't so obvious. Like at one point, my car was just drifting to the right. I know what is happening. I have no idea what's triggering it. Is it headlights on turning right? Which actually, that's what it ended up being. But it could this is easily been, is radio on, car turning right?
It kind
is
of door uses, closed,
car turning right?
Yeah, it kind of uses this like Fallout 3 style computer hacking mini game where you like enter in like four criteria or like three criteria and then the final outcome. And then it tells you for each of those columns, which of these are right and which of these are wrong. So it'll say,
you got 3 out of 4 right.
Oh, yeah, got 3 out of 4 right. So you know, okay, I can keep these, but I have to swap this one out. So that part of it was interesting. It did feel very much like a diversion. And like you said, like you feel good when you defeat them, when you beat them. But also like, what is that? You know, like
it's just... I mean, I had a couple of them that I solved and then they just came back a couple of runs later, the exact same ones. And that was frustrating. They do give your car character, I will say that. Like it makes your car have its own, like differentiated from everyone else's car.
Yeah.
Like you've got this unique issue that you're, like, which is true to life. Sometimes your car just, you can't put the gear shift into gear 3. That's just stuck, right? Or the window, you can't put down the window on the right door because it's stuck, whatever it is.
like I said, the car has 1,000 times more personality than the main character does.
Yeah, and that's the point, I think, largely. Yeah.
Speaking of the Tinker Station, all the UI in this game is really intriguing. Yes. There's a bunch of different computer systems, like I think it's called the Fabrication Station, the Fab Station, that it lets you unlock technology. There's a sort of like a message receiving station, like a fax
machine. Yeah.
Fax machine. And then there's like this decoration management station. And then the aforementioned tinkering. There's a sort of like readout for the car condition. All of it is like very attractively designed and laid out from a UI perspective.
It all looks very thematic. And in universe, everything is very diegetic. and feels like everything is happening. If everything is within the world that you're interacting with.
Right. But that said, I found the all the different UIs sort of bewildering.
A lot.
It's a lot to take in.
Yeah. And very overwhelming.
Very
and
busy.
Not laid out in a very intuitive sense.
Right. Yeah. It's enough.
Theme over function.
Yes. Eventually you'll get used to it and the UIs are quite usable, but they're just a little bit overwrought and a little hard to read and maybe a lot hard to read.
And like there's the catalog of like, here's a catalog of every item, every equipment, every car part in the game, and a catalog of what they all do. And it's all written by Paul Dean, I believe, did all those. And they're all very humorous, funny sort of little descriptions of all the items in the game. But they're very good at being funny and amusing, not very good at actually telling you what they do in the game.
Right. Yeah. This game has, I don't know. Is it early access?
No, it's
a full release game. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like, I don't know, this game frustrates me as much as it intrigues me. So I'm very glad that I played it.
It's not. It presents a lot of friction, both good and bad.
Right.
And that's something I've been thinking about a lot. I've also been playing Dragon's Dogma 2, which in a very similar vein, how games can challenge you and present friction in a good way. And I think this largely achieves it. It's a fine line between, especially with this setting and the mystery and the unknowable. And it wants to be a little esoteric, but then not just be frustrating to the player. That's a hard line to toe. I think it largely does it. Not always. But I think it's a pretty good job at presenting this a very very fascinating world and systems to interact with and the fun characters, if not the player character, then at least the car and everyone else. I am really enjoying this, the tone and the challenge of it. As you said, survival games have gotten very formulaic. Like, they're very safe, ironically, these days. But there's no punching trees here. There's no punch the tree, make an axe, build a base. It's very much doing its own thing. And I have to respect that. A game having its very unique play space.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I appreciate this game. I think this could easily be someone's favorite game.
Yeah.
And at very least, it's well worth taking for a spin. see what I did there? It's well worth trying out, especially because it's pretty cheap. I don't think it's a full retail title or anything like that. Full retail price, anyway.
There's a lot of game here. Like to finish this, I've heard like 60 hours or something, and it's pretty affordable for that. If like time versus money is important to you, that this game has that.
Yeah, I for one, I think I feel like I've gotten enough out of the loop of it. Mm-hmm. I've reached the mid zone, and I think I'll be happy to leave that kind of gloomy world. Just as the main character must. I wish that there was just a little bit more realization of the main character and even the side characters. Like maybe they'll actually create key art for some of them eventually. Hmm. Because I think just the story told in audio is just a little hard to follow.
Yeah.
So the story, I guess, I suppose, failed for me.
The story is just thrown at you, right? You don't. I think once you hit the mid zone, you start getting a lot more of that. And there are some sort of unlockable side things you can find. Like I found some like weird podcast or like radio show that was laying out some more of the backstory. But again, it's all just backstory and filling in the gaps. It's not really
like Alan Wake
forward. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm really enjoying it. I think hitting the mid zone is a lot more of the bad friction. I will say I'm sort of back at square one in terms of feeling like there's all these challenges that I can't easily overcome. But there's peaks and valleys to that challenge. So I am definitely going to be playing some more of this and I want to see where the story goes. And
very nice. You'll be keeping on the drive. I'll be pulling back into the garage, but either way, it's fun to take it out for a spin. Okay. Shall we talk about the next game we're going to be covering?
Absolutely. What are we talking about next episode?
Yes, I think we're going to, well, we're definitely going to be covering a tabletop game. We're going to be covering a board game, and I think we might have a guest. Are we going to announce the guest?
Let's not announce, but we have a returning guest, potentially, assuming that everything lines up, shall we say.
Great. So the game, we'll tell the game we're going to be looking at, though. It's called Let's Go to Japan, which, who is it? It's AHG. I kickstarted it. And I just happened to get an extra copy, and I bequeathed it to you.
Weird anomaly. Like, I don't know. You found an anomaly in the Olympic Peninsula that just duplicates board games.
Yeah, I ordered one, and I got two. And let's just say it ended up being a review copy to give to our professional game reviewer, Daniel Winter here. So we each have a copy. So we'll be checking out how well. It simulates planning a trip to Japan, which I have a lot of experience with, and also how well the porcelain bowls work as snack trays.
Yeah, they're called token bowls. That is obviously a typo. They are snack bowls.
Yeah, very attractive, game though. But we'll be digging in.
Yes,
full kicking the tires.
So stay tuned for that. If you have any questions or comments on this episode or the next, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. You can find me at Board Game Feast on Twitter or Blue Sky.
Yeah, you can find me as Omnigamer Mark on Instagram and Facebook. And you can visit our website at omnigamers.club if you want to subscribe to our podcast. And you know what? You may already have found us on YouTube or another video platform.
Yeah, we were experimenting with the format a little bit, so please do provide feedback. We don't usually go out of our way to sort of ask for reviews, but they are a big help, whatever platform you're listening to this on, whether it's Spotify or Apple or YouTube, potentially. So reviews, feedback, comments are always much appreciated.
Yeah, we really want to know what's working for you and what's not even, so we can better tune the stuff so you enjoy it more. So thanks a lot. I guess that's a wrap for this particular episode.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's it.
Yeah. So until next time. Yeah.
Drive into the garage.
There you go. And also have a balanced diet of gaming.
Thanks for listening.
Au revoir.
Bye.
Bye.